Ben Snyder, my associate, who's with me at the council table, and also David Fell, in-house counsel for MHC. I believe the state also has some introductions to make.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ola Ribicoff. I'm a deputy attorney general. I represent the state of Delaware in this appeal. At my counsel table is Deputy Attorney General Judy Hodes, the far left. She'll be presenting the rebuttal portion of the state's argument, and also Assistant Attorney General Kendra Basner.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, the issue before the court today is a question of first impression. Whether the escalator clause, or the rent cap, as appellees refer to it, is the type of provision that automatically renews under Section 7007B of the Manufactured Homeowners and Community Owners Act, or whether, as the appellees urge, it's a provision which relates to rent and is thus subject to modification. No Delaware court, or for that matter, we haven't been able to find a decision from any jurisdiction which has squarely addressed the question of whether escalator provisions in manufactured home community leases are provisions which renew automatically. However, the one Delaware case which considered the automatic renewal provisions of what used to be the Mobile Home Lots and Leases Act, Silverview versus Marsh, now is a decision that was decided about 10 years ago and affirmed by this court, proves very instructive because it squarely considered the issue of what constitutes rent in the sense of whether it's a term that relates to the amount and payment of rent. In Silverview v. Marsh, the question arose when the landlord, the owner of Silverview, presented a renewal lease which contained a new provision. That provision was a security deposit requirement, which up until that point was not in the leases. Now, as a general proposition, manufactured home community leases renew automatically year to year, term to term, on the same conditions and terms as the original lease. And the only thing that a landowner can change are provisions which relate to the amount and payment of rent. In Silverview, the landlord inserted a brand new security deposit requirement and argued, this is a security deposit requirement. It relates to rent. The tenant challenged that provision. And the tenant argued, no, this is a new provision. It's a new term, and it's not permissible because it doesn't relate to rent. To resolve the question, the Silverview court conducted an analysis to determine the function of the new provision. The court began by defining what is rent, and the court pointed out that rent is consideration from the tenant to the landlord for the use, occupancy, or possession of the premises. Then the court looked to see what is a security deposit. The court acknowledged that in certain circumstances, a security deposit can function as rent. But the court held that the function of a security deposit was to protect the landowner from tenant damage or waste. So in other words, the security deposit maintained the function of protecting the landlord and not the function of being consideration from the tenant to the landlord for the use, occupancy, or possession of the premises. Given that backdrop, the case at issue here involves an escalator provision or an escalation clause. It's also been referred to as the rent cap. That provision appeared in the original leases and provided that the landowner cannot increase the tenant's rent either by more than 5% or twice the consumer price index in any given year, whichever is greater. The issue arose because MHC unilaterally eliminated that provision from renewal leases. It disappeared. And the question is that a permissible modification? Can the landlord unilaterally eliminate a provision which otherwise under the law is supposed to renew automatically year to year or term to term, depending on how the lease defines it? The state respectfully submits that when looking at the function of an escalator clause, in the same way the Silverview case analogized the function of the security deposit, it becomes clear that the escalator clause is a very different provision and doesn't have a function related to the function of rent. If we begin again with the premise that rent is consideration that's paid from the tenant to the landlord for the use, occupancy, and possession of the property, the next question is, what is an escalation clause? An escalation clause is actually consideration that the landlord gives to the tenant as a form of tenant protection. It's not consideration that the tenant is paying to the landlord as is required in order to meet the definition of rent. It's consideration that the landlord gives to the tenant, which protects the tenant over a long period of time from runaway rent increases, from unlimited rent increases, which otherwise, under the statute, the landlord is allowed to enjoy. So the state's position in approaching the issue before the court today is that form cannot prevail over substance. The form, escalation clause, rent cap, ties in easily, and the state respectfully submits a little too literally into MHC's argument. MHC argues it's a rent cap. It has rent in it, therefore it relates to rent. End of story. And we respectfully submit, given the remedial objective of the law that's before the court today, and the function of the escalation clause is actually a form of consideration that the landlord grants to the tenant as a form of financial protection, long-term hardship protection, it doesn't function as rent. It's very different from rent. It's not even paid by the tenant. It's consideration which flows from the landlord.
Can I ask a more general question? Do you know whether most leases for manufactured home communities include some sort of escalator or control on rent increases?
Since we became involved in this case, Your Honor, we've learned that there are a number of manufactured home communities that use escalator provisions in these leases. And in fact, Your Honor, if I may, some of the cases that we point out, Lonegan, which is a Connecticut decision we signed in our reply brief, was struggling with the issue of trying to figure out if there was a long-term perpetual lease at issue. And the court said the fact that there was no escalator clause was evidence that a long-term perpetual lease wasn't contemplated. But in Delaware, we do see them not just in these communities, but in other communities.
I have two questions. You mentioned there was only one case, and you mentioned Silverview Farm. You didn't mention the opinion of the Superior Court in this case. Can you tell me where the court got it wrong as you see it in this case first? And then secondly, can you tell me what you mean by the, quote, remedial, close quote, objective of the law and how that relates to the issue?
Certainly, Your Honor. Just to steal the one fact that became evident when we read the court's opinion, ironically, this was the same judge that decided the Silverview case, and we tried to persuade him that his rationale extended to the rent cap analysis here. The court assumed incorrectly that the leases that were coming up for renewal here were being renewed for the very first time. In fact, the court held in its ruling in Section B3 of the opinion that when these leases come up for renewal, MHC is free to eliminate them. The parties imposed a burden on the court in the sense of urging the court to decide quickly. We stipulated to as many facts as we could. We did what we're supposed to do as advocates and presented a limited record, but a record we thought would help the court reach the appropriate conclusion. But in that sense, the court was incorrect because the face of the lease itself indicates that lease was executed in 1988. It had a 3-year term and was already renewing, or was completing the conclusion of its second term at the time of the court's decision. The other aspect of error...
What difference does that make?
Because when the court's opinion is read in the context of considering the rent cap issue, the court is assuming, and it holds as a matter of law, that the rent cap is restricted to the first term only. In other words, the court reads a restriction into the escalator clause that isn't there. It rules that there's a restriction that has to be read into the clause that limits it to the first term only, and after that, MHC is free to eliminate it. The difference is that these leases have in fact been renewing for years and many terms, and it wasn't a first-time renewal. the rent provision, the escalation clause, was renewing along with the leases over the years. And that's an important factor because I think that if the court had considered the course of conduct, a different result may have been reached.
Are you making a waiver argument?
The second portion of the state's argument in this appeal actually concerns a waiver argument. I'd be happy to address that.
Well, Justice Steele's question was, where did the trial court get it wrong? And I too would like to know if you can answer that in a sentence or two.
The trial court stopped at the form of the clause, looking at it as a rent cap and concluding it related to rent. It read the clause and the statute in a highly technical, literal sense. The trial court should have looked at the overall function of the clause as consideration from the landlord to the tenant that functions as a tenant protection, a ceiling on unlimited rent increases over the years. Comparing that, as it did in the Silverview case, to the definition of rent, the court would, in fact, have seen two very different provisions in operation. So respectfully, we submit that the court should have delved a little more into the depth of the matter and looked at that.
Are you saying that then the Superior Court really never addressed the issue that you put to it, which is there is a distinction between simply using the term rent in the so-called rent cap or escalator and approaching it from the point of view of consideration that passes from the tenant to the landlord for the right to occupy the property?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that was the same definition that the court used in the Silverview case. So that was the barometer against which the court measured the security deposit and ran its analysis.
I just want to make sure that I understand your argument, Ms. Rybakov. Is it correct that the current leases have a fixed amount per month or per year is the rent?
That's correct. There's an annual amount.
And it's payable monthly, right?
I believe so, Your Honor.
What if the rent clause had as part of its language that in each successive year the rent will increase in the discretion of the landlord but by no more than 5% or twice the CPI? Would that change your position?
I don't think it would change our position, Your Honor. It would make the argument stronger because that would be a more express designation of the renewable nature of the rent cap. The difficulty here is MHC, as the landowner, and if I may, Justice Steele, the court asked about the remedial aspects that we discussed. These laws were passed as remedial laws to protect tenants, which is generally recognized as a very uneven playing field. The state, to a great extent, covered these issues in the opening portion of the brief, but the point is that when a tenant is evicted from a community in a manufactured home, it's not just the tenant that's evicted, it's the home. And this can be an incredible expense. In some cases, and in many cases, these homes can cost thousands of dollars to move. Tenants in these communities are often elderly, lower income, fixed income, and manufactured home community living provides an ideal form of affordable housing and is very popular throughout the country. To prevent overreaching, many jurisdictions, including Delaware, passed special manufactured home community landlord-tenant laws that address the peculiar and unique circumstances. For example, unlike the residential landlord-tenant code, manufactured home community tenants cannot be evicted except for cause. So when a lease expires under the law, it renews automatically and again and again. And the only way a landlord can terminate is for cause, non-payment of rent, damage of property, things like that. The other added protection is what we loosely term perpetual leases. They're not really perpetual because the landowner always retains the right to close the park and change its use. But tenants go into these residential relationships contemplating a very long-term residency. And for that reason, the law is written to protect tenants. It vests enforcement authority in the Attorney General's office, specifically in the Consumer Protection Division, and it contains a liberal construction mandate at the very outset. requiring the law to be interpreted in a way that would improve the quality of life for tenants and landlords alike. And it's this very important objective of the law the state respectfully submits is undermined if the lease here is interpreted in a way that could effectively economically evict dozens, if not hundreds, of tenants for financial reasons. And if that helps answer the question. The other point in the state's appeal was, in fact, a waiver argument. And the state argued that manufactured home communities knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily waived its statutory right to otherwise enjoy unlimited rent increases by choosing to put a ceiling, an escalation clause, into its leases.
You're now into your rebuttal time.
In that case, we leave the court. I will just sum up briefly and urge the court to consider that given the remedial nature of the law, the function of an escalation provision as a long-term protection for tenants and a form of consideration that the landlord grants to the tenants, we respectfully ask that the court reverse the decision below and alternatively, perhaps in this case, more of a factual development on the record could assist the court, so perhaps in the alternative, a remand would be appropriate.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I begin with the rather fundamental precept of statutory construction that was enunciated by Judge Graves in a 1998 case entitled Bundy versus Corrado Brothers. And that is that courts are bound to give effect to the literal meaning of statutory language without consulting other indicia of intent or meaning whenever the meaning of the statutory language itself is plain and clear or unambiguous. In this particular case, MHC respectfully submits that the provisions of Section 7007B of Title 25 are not ambiguous and must be given their plain meaning. That is, if a lease provision relates to the amount or payment of rent, it may be modified upon expiration and renewal of the lease term. The lease provision here at issue, the rent cap, or the escalator clause, no matter what it may be called, operates to limit or cap the amount by which rent may be increased during the term of the lease. Therefore, the term obviously relates to the amount of rent. The state's argument that this court must look toward the function of a lease term that is outside of the statute in order to interpret the statute itself has no bearing from Silverview. Silverview does not stand for the proposition here urged that in interpreting Section 7007B, this court must look to the function of a lease provision to determine whether it benefits the landlord or the tenant in order to conclude whether the provision can be modified or must be renewed pursuant to Section 7007B.
Mr. Party, I didn't take the suggestion that the relation to function was directed toward who it benefited. I took it to mean that when you look at the purpose of the language in the lease, namely the rent cap, that since it didn't pertain to a modification in exchange of consideration, but was intended as a part of the lease to assure a tenant that the rent would not be increased above that particular amount, that it didn't relate to the actual payment of rent in the form of exchange of consideration. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be happy to. The state's interpretation would effectively read out of the statute the phrase relate to. That is, the state's interpretation of the lease provision and Section 7007B as it applies to that provision is that unless the provision specifically dictates the amount of rent or how it is paid, then it doesn't relate or it can't be modified. That is, in order for the state's position to prevail, you would have to read the words relate to out of the statute. The legislature did not say in Section 7007B that only the rent itself or how it is paid can be modified. What the legislature said was that provisions relating to the amount and payment of rent may be modified. So obviously the legislature meant the statutory provision to include something more than just the rent itself.
You read relating the words relating to broadly to mean in connection with?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And I recognize that it's possible to interpret the phrase relating to differently, that it's a relative term perhaps. But frankly, we believe that Judge Graves got it right in this case. And we believe that he got it right in Silverview, that a security deposit does not relate to the amount and payment of rent because it doesn't have any direct connection. It doesn't primarily relate to the amount and payment of rent. Sure, indirectly a security deposit because in part it's designed to afford some protection against rent that's not paid has some relation, but it's very remote because its principal purpose is to act as insurance for the landlord against damage.
Purpose meaning function, right?
Correct, correct. But even if you, I think an important point to note is that even if you follow liberal interpretation of the phrase relate to, you have to look at the purpose or function of this provision. It's important to note, I think, that Section 7007B is one of the very few, if not the only, landlord protections left in a manufactured home community. That is, it's a landlord right that allows the landlord to modify provisions relating to the amount and payment of rent. So if it's to be construed liberally to give effect to the intent or purpose of the act, which is to clarify and establish the rights of landlords and tenants, then it ought to be construed in favor of the landlord here. It is, after all, a statutory provision designed to protect the landlord right.
You're injecting a term that's far into the analysis, liberal construction. Do you mean broad interpretation or narrow?
I mean that it should be broadly construed to clarify and establish the rights of landlords as well as tenants. And this provision in particular is one of the few provisions in the code that affords a landlord a right, that is to modify provisions relating to the amount and payment of rent, and therefore it ought to be construed liberally in favor of the landlord, if at all, in favor of one party or the other.
I'm curious about the same thing that I asked opposing counsel, and I would like your information on it. Is it a common feature of all leases, or almost all leases, for manufactured home communities to have some sort of an escalator or rent cap provision?
Your Honor, I honestly do not know. I believe that it is more common in today's practice than it has been in the past. In our communities, several of our communities do have rent caps, but some of them do not. And I believe that that experience probably mirrors the general experience. That is, many do, but many do not.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how it all works, because without this provision, if somebody new came into one of the communities here, you'd be free to give them a new lease that has nothing to do with the existing lease that's at issue here. And that new lease could set the rent at anything you wanted, right?
That's correct.
And it would not have to have a rent cap provision in it, correct?
That's correct.
And if it were a 1 or 3 year lease, then that tenant 1 or 3 years later could face rent being doubled or tripled.
That's correct.
Because the statute says you are free to adjust the amount of the rent, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm trying to understand this from a practical perspective. How could somebody do that as a tenant, take that risk that in a few years the cost of renting the space on which their home is located could become astronomical?
Well, unfortunately, that's the nature of this particular market. I don't know that that there's any answer other than market forces. There are many, many communities, especially in Sussex County, that offer leases, and so presumably there are a number of alternatives for tenants to seek. They also don't have to buy the home. I mean, there are parks that rent the home as well, but in this particular circumstance, I believe your question is directed to the situation where that home is purchased and then brought in. I think that that's a business decision the tenant has to make, and
Well, and that's really why I was asking you how common are these rent cap provisions, because if you told me that virtually every lease has a rent cap provision, then that would explain, you know, how people who are moving in could have some comfort in what their costs are going to be. But you're saying that there are places where there's no such provision and people still move in and face the uncertainty of having significant rent increases in the near future.
That's correct, Your Honor. But we do in many of our parks have rent cap provisions, and I think it's a give and take on both the tenant and the landlord's part. The landlord obviously wants to fill his park, and if he routinely increases his rent dramatically, he's going to drive tenants out of his park and into parks elsewhere. And so I think it would be a very unwise landlord who would repeatedly raise his rents by an astronomical amount and take advantage of the right under the statute to do so. The right is there, but I think market forces suggest that a landlord will be reasonable if he does not have a cap. And for this reason, I think you see a lot of landlords and tenants negotiate that. I hope that answers your question. I would like to move on to the question of whether or not this statute is a remedial consumer protection statute. And I would submit that the mere fact that Title 29, in particular Chapter 25, gives the Attorney General the authority to enforce the Manufactured Home Community Act does not convert the act into a remedial consumer protection statute, particularly when the language of the act doesn't authorize or suggest any such purpose.
Suppose you were incorrect on that point. Would it make a difference to your
position? I don't believe so. In this particular case, I don't see how the state can escape the unambiguous language of Section 7007B, even if this were a remedial consumer protection statute. As I said at the beginning, where the language of the statute is clear and unambiguous, you need not resort to other indicia of the intent or meaning.
Well, doesn't it go this way? If it's a consumer protection statute, it's a remedial statute. It's to be read in favor of one party as opposed to another. Therefore, if there is any construction that favors that party, that's the construction that should be the one held by the court to apply. Isn't that the way the theme goes?
That is the argument, yes, Your Honor. But that presumes that the statutory provision is ambiguous, and I would submit that in this case it is not.
You conceded, I thought, that there is a less broad way, a narrower way that the term in relating to can be construed. And indeed, the amicus has suggested a narrower construction, and I think neither side has really addressed that.
I believe the amicus brief suggested that the other interpretation was on account of, if I'm not mistaken. And again, that gets back to the argument that the state makes, that the provision ought to be read so that if the provision, that is, the statutory provision ought to be read such that it only applies to the rent itself or how it's paid. And essentially it would read out the words relate to. The amicus position, I believe, would read out the meaning of the phrase relate to. Obviously the legislature meant this provision to include something more than just the rent provisions themselves. It meant to include provisions relating to. And when you look at the provision here in question, a provision which determines how much the rent is going to be in the future, I don't see how you can conclude that that doesn't relate to the amount of rent under any construction of the phrase relate to.
Including on account of?
Yes, including on account of. Because the provision here in question actually does determine what the rent would be in the future. It's a cap on rent increases. So it is as directly as could possibly be related to the amount of rent under any interpretation of the phrase relate to. I would also point out that the Attorney General has the authority under Chapter 29 to enforce the Residential Landlord-Tenant Code. And that mere fact does not mean that the Residential Landlord-Tenant Code, out of which our act grew, is also interpreted in favor of tenants, particularly in a situation where the statutory language is clear and unambiguous, and again, we point back to Section 7001A of this Act, which suggests that the Act is to be interpreted to clarify and establish the rights and obligations of landlords and tenants equally. It does not suggest any interpretation in favor of either party. If I may, I see I have a few minutes left. I'd like to address the right of entry provision.
Yes, I have a question about the right of entry provision.
Yes, sir.
I get the impression from the briefs that both sides are shadow boxing. I don't know what's really at stake here. What is the problem?
Well, I think practically speaking, that's an excellent question. Practically speaking, if we lose this argument, then the tenants would have an unfettered right to prohibit the landlord or any representative of the landlord from ever coming onto their lot for any reason or no reason at their total whim and caprice. And the problem is that there are very many legitimate reasons why a landlord must enter onto the lot, including the maintenance and repair and reading of utilities, and that can oftentimes be performed by parties who are not necessarily the landlord, but companies perhaps who have been contracted by the landlord for water or sewer or electric utilities who need to come onto the lot to read the meters. There are a whole host of other reasons enumerated in the Act why the landlord may have a legitimate reason to come on to the site. Now, the Act, I think, is very clear in providing that even if the landlord wants to come onto the lot for any one of those reasons, he still has to respect the privacy of the tenant, and he cannot attempt to enter into, under, or on the home itself without the tenant's permission or in the event of an emergency. And there's some threat to property damage or life. So what's really at stake, to answer Your Honor's question, is whether or not landlords and utility companies, for example, are going to have to beg for permission of the tenant to come onto their lot to maintain utilities, to inspect property which belongs to the landlord and is the landlord's obligation to maintain. There is, I believe, some seeing of ghosts behind trees to suggest that landlords are going to exploit this ability to enter onto the home site in order to disturb the resident's right to privacy.
Doesn't that same argument work in reverse? Why would the tenant say, no, you're not allowed to come on here and fix a problem on this land, or no, you're not allowed to come on here to read the meter? You seem to be assuming that the tenants are going to be unreasonable, and yet you say, why would we be unreasonable?
I agree that it takes two to tango, if you will, that it does depend upon communication and respect flowing from both sides. The problem, I believe, Your Honor, and of course this is not in the record, but I represent to the court that in my experience representing manufactured home park owners, it is often the case that tenants refuse to allow the landlord or representatives of the landlord or agents of the landlord to come onto the lot for any reason or no reason. And so it would be my fear that if this part of the law is not clarified, as we suggest in our briefs, that is, the landlord has a right to come onto the home site for legitimate reasons so long as they continue to respect the privacy of the resident and they do not attempt to enter into, on, or under the home except as allowed. And with regard to the home, the tenant's right is absolute. They can prohibit the landlord from entering into, on, or under the home unless there's an emergency. That if that law is not clarified, that the confusion will continue and that there will be a situation will develop where tenants will believe they have the right to unilaterally prohibit landlords from coming onto the home site for any reason or no reason at all. And so I think this is an opportunity for the court to clarify the landlord's right to come onto the home site and the restrictions that would apply in those circumstances versus the tenant's right to prohibit the landlord from entering into, under, or on the home.
At the risk of turning back to the law, can you tell me where the trial judge got it wrong in this case on this argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that Judge Graves was confused by the language of the lease. That is, he found certain phrases in the lease to be vague or want for vagueness. In particular, I think he focused on the phrase damage to the community. Well, the statute uses the phrase injury to person or injury to property. So I would submit that the statute is actually broader in what it permits than our lease provision. That is, our lease provision would only allow us to go into the home if there was damage to property, but not injury to person. But the bottom line is, I think it's fair to say that the lease reflects or attempts to reflect what the Act says, and the Act itself is not entirely clear. And so I think just out of an abundance of caution, Judge Graves said it's not perfectly clear based on the lease agreement, and therefore I find that paragraphs 4 and paragraph 12 violate the Act. Of course, the Act has changed somewhat. It's a little more clear now than it was. And I would submit if you read paragraph 4 and paragraph 12 of our lease provisions very clearly and you interpret them literally, there is nothing in our lease agreement which authorizes us to go into, under, or on the home without the tenant's permission. The paragraphs 4 and paragraph 12 merely allow the landlord to go onto the home site for legitimate reasons that comport with the Act. And I think Judge Graves just didn't see the distinction.
There isn't some vagueness that arises out of the term home site then. It was the purposes for which one would enter the home site.
The term home site is not defined by the Act, and that perhaps is the answer to Your Honor's question. The term home site is not defined by the Act. It is defined by our lease. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Judy Okunhotis, and I need to rebut a few of the points made by opposing counsel. My first point is that the Silverview case has already interpreted the phrase relate to be construed narrowly. In that case, Judge Graves ruled that, and this Court affirmed, that the deposit could be used as rent, but that the language has to be interpreted narrowly, and therefore it would be interpreted narrowly in this case to find that the clause in issue here does not relate to rent.
Let's assume that we agree with that premise. What would be the narrow construction of the words relating to that would result in the decision of the court below being reversed?
The clause at issue here, it does not relate to rent because rent is consideration from the landlord, from the tenant to the landlord, and the clause at issue is consideration from the landlord to the tenant.
Couldn't you say that the escalator clause limits the amount of consideration that would have to flow from the tenant to the landlord?
It loosely pertains to the amount of rent, but particularly in light of liberal construction of the statute in favor of tenants, protecting tenants' rights.
Can you suggest a construction of the words relating to that would support your position, that would lead us to the conclusion that you're arguing for?
That relate to would have to be a direct relationship.
I take it that means you're saying that the only direct relationship to rent would be the exact amount and term for the rent, or
yes,
perhaps the time by which it had to be paid.
Or the form in which it has to be paid, for example, by cash or check, factors such as those. As to Justice Berger's concern as to whether there are a number of as to whether tenants are relying on rent caps for certainty about the future, and opposing counsel's comment that they are that without a rent cap they are simply in the marketplace. The state would take the position that the statute contemplates only reasonable rent increases, because rent increases such as those suggested by Justice Berger could be construed to be a de facto eviction, so that the landlord is evicting the tenant by an unreasonable rent increase, an unconscionable rent increase, without following the requirements of the statute under which the situations under which a tenant can be evicted are very narrow and limited.
Why didn't the state simply establish a rent control program?
That's a legislative question I can't answer.
But you're telling me throughout the argument, telling us throughout the argument what the legislature intended. You're advocating a rent control process, aren't you?
Only where the landlord has already agreed to a self-imposed limit.
Okay.
I see I'm out of time.
Thank you. The court appreciates the arguments of counsel, and we will reserve decision and stand in recess.
Please rise.